Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I am joined in with a very special guest, somebody that I actually discovered on one of my favorite forums online, which is the Ray Pete Forum. And I came across one of his articles on Medium, and I was instantly captivated and astonished by the level of detail that this gentleman was going through. So what I want to do is welcome, he goes by the name Things Various online. So welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome. So maybe do you want to give my listeners a bit of a background into, I guess, your journey and how you sort of got so interested in understanding hormones?
It started when I'm a medical student. Now I'm in my final year. But during my first year, basically, I went through a period where my personality started to change. I got more withdrawn. I had less energy. And I just didn't feel like myself anymore. And being a medical student, I started to look into things more closely. And what I discovered after doing lots of experimenting myself and like everybody else trying out different things, like from fasting to stimulants and so on, I discovered that my testosterone was very low. And after going to many, many doctors and nobody could really help me, they all said I was fine because my total testosterone was in range. But at one time I figured that, yeah, despite my total testosterone being in range, my free testosterone was very low, actually. And I looked more closely at other hormones. And what I discovered was that for some reason, multiple of my hormonal axes were failing. So I was low in multiple of them. And being a medical student, being young and quite, yeah, I like risk, I started to experiment. And what I figured out was that how much better you could feel, how much easier life is, how much more enjoyable life is if I started to replace them. And this, the start was rocky, but after, I would say, roughly around 1 to 2 years of intense studying, experimenting, researching, doing blood work and stuff like that, I came to a point where I realized that it's not going to do it. if I replace one or two of my hormones, because hormones need to be in balance. And if I just replace one or two, mine, at least for me, the other ones were suboptimal. They were not in balance with each other. And I arrived at a state where now I replace all of them. And I've learned so many things along the way. And I know from personal experience and from friends and family that so many of us have hormonal imbalances, and they can really destroy your life. And we are usually just not aware of the invisible forces that are basically being there in the background all the time, influencing how we feel, how we think, how much energy we have, how much others like being around us, how we look. And given there is no really comprehensive research out there, I thought I might share online with what I've learned and discovered on my way in like a no bullshit way, because there's just so much misinformation when it comes to hormones. Most doctors, they are completely unaware. They do not even recognize like neon flashing signs of hormonal deficiencies. And that results in a lot of suffering for a lot of people out there.
So what I want to do is sort of backtrack and go through some of the testing that you did in your early days. Like, did you simply just order, you know, get blood tests done privately? And then did you use any advanced testing like the Dutch test at all? Or
no. So what I did actually, like, we're in Europe and it's quite easy for us to get blood work done by a doctor. If, especially for me as a medical student, I just go there and say what I want and what I need, and they just usually they just give it to you. And then I got lots of testing done myself, and I usually told the doctors it's for a special appointment at an endocrinologist, and this is what I need, all these tests. And they were just we don't even check it, and they just gave me all the tests at 1.5. And it's very hard to test for hormones though. So blood work is usually not enough. You really also need to check for signs and symptoms, and also tests like saliva tests and stuff like that. They're all worthless. So the only way I think is reasonable to do, other than urinary cortisol tests, is to go via blood work. But you need to look especially at the free level of hormones, because for me, for example, my testosterone was in range in my early days. But the reason was not because my testosterone was okay. The reason was because my sex hormone binding globulin, which is a protein that binds up the fraction of testosterone, leaving just around like 30 to 40% free and bioavailable, was very high, binding up most of my testosterone my cells couldn't use.
Interesting. So now we're sort of touching on testosterone. I can sort of chime in and add my experience there. I mean, I managed to get my total testosterone to 988 nanograms per deciliter, which is quite high. I got that, you know, naturally through various methods. You know, I was eating, you know, very high calorie diet. I was training very heavy, like, you know, squatting heavy, things like that. But my SHBG was also very high. And it's funny that you mentioned that. So let's focus in on SHBG. I want to ask you more about what can drive up SHBG.
So the thing is, SHBG is a protein that is expressed and synthesized by hepatocytes, which are liver cells. And there are multiple transcription factors that regulate its production. And most of these transcription factors are hormonal. So all the hormones drive down SHBG, but the thyroid drives it up. And the most important of these hormones is insulin. If your insulin is very high, especially if you're a high calorie diet, I mean, especially a high carbohydrate diet, your SHBG is going to go down by a lot. And if your insulin is low, for example, you do intermittent fasting, you do ketogenic diets, or you are on caloric restriction, then your SHBG will rise. And many people that go on ketogenic diets and do fasting protocols, they actually turn out to have very SHBG, being fooled that just their testosterone is normal or high, even though it is not. You really need to look at like free testosterone.
Interesting. So I want to, then I want to sort of delve into, let's sort of Let's go back to thyroid, because I know you've had a lot of experience replacing your thyroid hormone. So there was one key point that you mentioned in one of these articles that it really surprised me. And it was the relationship between how no matter how much thyroid you replaced, if your cortisol was low, you would never increase your body temperature. So,
oh, yeah.
Man, so tell us more about that.
Yeah, I actually found that out the hard way, because I knew like what a physiological temperature looks like. And even online, there are tons and tons of people in different communities that track their thyroid status via our vital signs, which is blood pressure, temperature, and our pulse. But what many of these find empirically is that no matter how much thyroid they take, I mean, the body temperature does rise slightly, but it doesn't go up if cortisol is low. For one, cortisol, I mean, all the hormones, they act on nuclear receptors, which means they directly affect gene expression. And there are sometimes genes that need in their promoter region, which means determining how much a certain gene is expressed, a combination of different transcription factors. Mm. And if one of them is lacking, this is going to be the missing link or the limiting factor. And for example, like with probably many genes associated with body temperature, like ion channels and stuff like that, you need both of the hormones in adequate levels. And it's getting much more complex than this, but cortisol basically elevates our basal metabolic rate partially by upregulating our sympathetic drive, our sympathetic nervous system, which means our adrenergic tone. And if cortisol is very low, so will be your adrenergic tone. And how thyroid also stimulates body temperature is by increasing adrenergic tone as well. But cortisol increases the number of receptors for adrenaline and noradrenaline. So if either one of these is low, your body temperature is going to be low because of a lot of factors. I just touched like on two of them. They're not even fully elucidated, but empirically, you can try. I mean, I tried going up higher in thyroid. I tried to titrate up the dosage. At one point, I was using T3 only, which is quite a radical therapy, which I do not recommend, and which is the active form of thyroid hormone. But even if I increased by a lot, being well in the super physiological range, my body temperature just didn't get any higher. And even adding very small dosages of cortisol, it like the temperature shut up and I had to like decrease my total dose of T3. I do not recommend this. It was just for science.
Of course, of course. So what I want to know more about is cortisol replacement. Now, I am also someone with, according to my Dutch test, my total metabolized cortisol was so low that it was off the actual chart. It was actually so low. And back at the time, unfortunately, I was also anemic. So I know that there was low iron can influence cortisol secretion. I've looked into the research there. But this is the thing. I don't want to go ahead and use something like licorice, which can, you know, licorice can help. No. So the thing is, the solution for me, it's if I, you know, used hydrocortisone, which I haven't, but my dad's a pharmacist and I can get some very easily. The issue with that is like, right, replacement. Well, then what about the negative feedback? Then if I stop taking it, am I going to be suppressed even more?
Yeah. So there were many questions, actually. The thing is, let's start off with hormonal suppression. It all depends on how plastic/resilient your hypothalamus and pituitary are. Let's say you have two people on 10 milligrams of hydrocortisone or any other hormone. Usually, for most people, suppression is just partial, which means, let's say, 30 to 40%, even after it has reached equilibrium after a few months. And it's just temporary. Which means that once you taper off, then the negative feedback falls away and hypothalamus is sending out signals again, leading your glands to secrete more of the hormone and also to hypertrophy again. But here is the issue that some people, they actually, the reason their one or multiple hormones is low, they have hypothalamic issues. It's not adrenal fatigue. No, it's that has nothing to do with the adrenals. It's your hypothalamus that's not sending the signals. And if you're one of these people, then even very small doses of cortisol can actually suppress you fully. And this can be dangerous because if you wean off or if you stop suddenly, that could theoretically, I mean, it's not likely not going to happen, but in the worst case, it could actually result in an adrenal crisis, which it means you have no cortisol, you have circulatory collapse, and it's a life-threatening situation. But yeah, for most people, small doses of cortisone, they do not fully suppress them. I mean, cortisol is a very important hormone, and it's very rare that someone is completely suppressed, which means their ACTH is zero. That's the stimulating hormone for the adrenals. Given small physiological dosages are used, if you use hydrocortisone, if you use prednisone or dexamethasone, two synthetic corticosteroids that have a very long half-life, yeah, then you're going to be suppressed, even at small dosages. I do not recommend these.
Right. So there's a clear distinction there between... So hydrocortisone is basically mimicking that... Like, it's like TRT, right? But it's like...
Yes and no.
Okay.
So the thing is... Our cells have a balance between cortisol and cortisone, cortisone is the inactive form. And there is an enzyme, it's called hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 1 and 2, and they mediate the interconversion between these two. And for normal people, the ratio between these two hormones in the tissues is around 0.8. It's determined by different metabolite ratios. It's very technical, again, very, very technical now, and probably many are not interested. But if you use hydrocortisone, then your ratio is going to shoot up probably to 1.1. And if you use cortisone acetate, which is what I use, the inactive form of cortisol, so the cortisone, which needs to be activated by the liver and the tissues, then your tissue ratio is going to be 0.6, 0.5. Right. So if you actually use hydrocortisone, giving the active form of cortisol, your liver is getting a disproportionate dose of hydrocortisone in one go, and lots of that cortisol escapes out into the circulation in the active form. But normally when our body secrete it, they also go through the liver, but in a more sustained way, and the liver can regulate the balance between these hormones. So actually giving hydrocortisone actually leads to you having more cortisol tissue exposure compared to our normal natural secretion. Whereas if you use a cortisone acetate, which is I use, which I think is much better and safer, then you have a lower tissue exposure of total glucocorticoid load.
Interesting. So when, like, let's say, I want to look at some of the effects on body composition. Like, did you notice any changes in... Yeah, so do you want to explore that?
Yeah. For cortisol, actually, I was super scared because I knew that from the medical literature, and also I've personally seen it myself, that if your area under the curve cortisol, how much cortisol you're exposed to daily, that does a lot of damage from metabolic syndrome to fat, adipose tissue accumulation in trunk fat, the moon phase, the hair loss, the graying, all the kind of things. But it will mess up your lipid profile. But now, after 3 years of replacing my cortisol with, I would say, an average replacement dose, I've noticed nothing. My metabolic health improved. I've not gained any body fat. I'm around usually around like 8%. Noticed nothing with hair or fat. So the fear for me, at least, was completely unfounded. But I also have to admit that I do replace the anabolic hormones and other hormones, thyroid and growth hormone, and they require higher cortisol needs because metabolism increases, and depending on how fast your metabolism is, your cortisol needs go up. But if someone would replace cortisol in isolation and not at least have adequate amounts of anabolic hormones, then the cortisol is going to be much more powerful because it's first unopposed, and second, you don't have the metabolic rate that needs a higher cortisol. So you cannot... give a blanket statement that somebody everybody needs, for example, the dose I need.
Interesting. Oh, man, super interesting stuff. Well, what I want to do is maybe for my listeners, you want to give them a bit of a snapshot of the differences in what you felt from a very low cortisol state to a very high cortisol state.
Actually, I'm not. I don't have a high cortisol state because I do measure my ACTH, which is the signal sent from my hypothalamus to my adrenals, and it's well in range. And also, I did a free urinary cortisol test on cortisol replacement, even though I thought because of the spillover, it's going to be falsely elevated. No, it was not. It was completely normal for some reason. It's very unexplainable to me. But cortisol for me was the hormone that made by far the biggest improvement. While I didn't notice much from TRT, even going from a level of testosterone half the normal reference range in the free testosterone, which is like a castrate level basically, to being at the very top of the reference range, changes were meh. Like, I mean, I did notice improvements in energy, muscle composition a little bit. Also with thyroid, my baseline energy, it was elevated quite a bit, but it was not like an in-your-face change. Changes were occurring over a few months. But with cortisol, the first time I took it, I just took 2.5 milligrams of hydrocortisone, and I started shaking. Like, I really started shaking. I just felt how my body was chock full with adrenaline because my body was deprived so long from this essential steroid. And for the first time in years, I have had like a really clear head without taking a cold shower, without doing some exercise, without drinking some coffee. And I just have seen the potential, how life-changing that could be. But I'm a very sciencey guy, and I was very well aware how dangerous replacing cortisol is. And it took me actually a very long time and a lot of thinking and feeling bad and going through the literature and looking at different other people online, their journeys, and experimenting myself and just waiting for these 2 years. Now that I can say I'm very comfortable in what I'm doing is both good for my health and especially good for my well-being and day-to-day functioning.
Interesting. So just remind me, so your very first experience was with hydrocortisone at 2.5 milligrams. Is that your very first introductory dose?
Actually, no, it was with around 3.3 milligrams of cortisone acetate, which would equate to around 2.5 hydrocortisone.
Right. And so that very first response, you got the, it was a shock to the system? Like, what happened?
Yeah, it was like not a shock. I probably overplayed it a little, but it was like in your head, now there is something happening, even at this tiny, in your face, at this tiny, comparably tiny dosage. For fun/science, I also gave the same replacement dose or not replacement dose, the same dose to a few of my friends. And 2 out of 3 haven't noticed anything.
Wow. So that goes to show you that you really, really needed it, right? Like, so I think you said, like, you will know whether or not you're deficient because once you replace it, you will feel it, right?
Yeah, but there are dangers to it. I mean, many people do contact me because of the stuff I've written, and multiple of them, they actually have very high dosages of hydrocortisone. They go up to like 30, 40, even 50 milligrams per day, which is just way too much. Of course, you're going to feel these dosages and you feel good. You feel vital. You're full of energy, warm body temperature, clear in your head, maybe even euphoria. I mean, in psychiatry, they even say the steroid euphoria, because corticosteroids, for example, used in autoimmune issues, they can induce psychosis and mania. Yep. It's the only hormone that can do that. And it's very dangerous to abuse cortisol as a stimulant. It's the most dangerous stimulant out there. I mean, it is prohibited by the WADA, so the International Doping Organization, because of its potent stimulatory effects. It releases blood nutrients. It elevates your sympathetic drive. It increases dopamine like nothing else. The number of dopamine receptors, every step in the signaling cascade of dopamine neurotransmission. And this is dangerous because you might feel very good on 5 milligrams more, hydrocortisone or cortisone acetate per day, but you're going to make a long-term trade-off with your future health and longevity. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this trade-off is necessarily bad, because let's say, for example, you do this for half a year, and then this time now, or you're opening up a company, you're writing a book, you're doing whatever will further your life situation in beneficial ways, and you're going to benefit from that years down the line. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that from a health perspective, if your area under the curve cortisol remains too high for too long, yes, you're going to run into problems.
Yeah, look, this is, it's just so fascinating, because now I'm gluing together a lot of the things that I've used in the past. For example, one of my articles, it actually went viral, where I was talking about ashwagandha, how it can induce, I don't know if you've seen it, where it can induce anhedonia, because it's so potently lowering cortisol. And, you know, I'm trying to find ways to, like, I've been looking at different ways to, how can I boost my cortisol? I don't want to use licorice. I've tried, you know, the...
No, licorice is crap, because that is even more dangerous than hydrocortisone, because licorice, it inactivates an enzyme. It inactivates the hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, whatever, type 2, which is present in your mineralocorticoid tissues that respond to aldosterone. And they basically inactivate cortisol there, because cortisol has mineralocorticoid effects. But the danger is that it's very very highly expressed in the kidneys,
right,
which means now your kidneys, as a select tissue, get a disproportionate load of cortisol. And cortisol is going to be super catabolic there. And you're going to wreck your long-term kidney health, even though you might elevate area under the curve cortisol in your plasma a little bit. So, I mean, it's just a drug. It's glycerolic acid, the molecule that does that. Why not use, like, the real version of hydrocortisone and give every tissue the same dose? Why use a plant? Because one is natural and the other is not? No, our cells and enzymes don't care whether a molecule is synthesized by a plant or a laboratory or the human body.
Right. I want to transition over into the fludrocortisone, because I also, whether or not it's a genetic thing, my dad, my grandmother, they love salt, and I'm the exact same. In fact, there have been times when I need the salt, otherwise I'm going to, like, my blood pressure, I saw that at one stage your blood pressure was like 105 over what? Mine's lower, man. Like, mine is ridiculous.
Really?
Yeah, it's very, very low.
How do you feel? I mean, some people do compensate and feel quite well, but I certainly didn't.
I experienced the muscle weakness, and that's the worst symptom, is because, like, if my blood pressure's crashed and I'm not retaining the sodium, I'm not getting the muscle pumps, and I feel weak and dizzy, and I shouldn't be getting weak and dizzy. Like, you know what I mean? So,
So in my opinion, fludrocortisone is very underused. I mean, it's not ideal per se, because many tissues have mineralocorticoid receptors, for example, the heart and others. And if you use it in high dosages, there is going to be some remodeling. This is why some endocrinologists are scared of. But if I use, for example, 0.1 milligrams per day, which is a normal aldosterone secretion, but despite not being ideal per se, it allows me to reduce my cortisol dose. And now, what do we want? Do we want the pest or the plague or the cholera? I choose the cholera. I mean, I'm lowering my cortisol dose at the same time I'm going higher in fludrocortisone. It's certainly healthier than increasing my cortisol dose without the fludrocortisone.
Have you looked into anything that can block or antagonize aldosterone? Like, what are the other, are there any other, like, can thyroid impact aldosterone or anything?
Do you want to increase aldosterone or decrease?
I want to increase, because that's going to help with the sodium retention.
You're going to eat a lot of potassium.
That's just it's so confusing.
The physiological role of aldosterone is not really the salt retention. It's much more the potassium secretion, because evolutionarily, We ate a lot of stuff that contained lots of potassium, all this plant stuff. I mean, we also ate a lot of animals, but we did eat some very low-calorie plants, and they had contained a lot of potassium. And the primary stimulus for aldosterone secretion is twofold. For one, it's angiotensin II, which is a hormone elevating your blood pressure from the kidneys. And the other thing that directly affects the cells synthesizing aldosterone is an increased plasma potassium.
Interesting.
And the cortisol now, the aldosterone now, leads to the expression of potassium secretion channels in certain cells in the kidneys, and at the same time to sodium retaining channels. I don't want to get too much into science, but yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. I want to go back to more like the everyday person. I want to look at this topic here. Let's talk about how cortisol can influence your emotional depth and how. Let's look at that.
All right. So let's say you fall in love, and now you don't have any hunger. You can't sleep. You're quite euphoric all day. Well, that's cortisol. I mean, there's quite a lot of scientific data out there that the HPA in the first time of passionate love, in this first period, it's going into overdrive. Like, your cortisol secretion is actually almost doubled. It makes evolutionarily sense because now you have this found this mate. You need to bond. You're going to stay with him, her for life. And you better have all the energy available to keep her and to get after her. And in this state, cortisol is very high. You are quite emotional. You are very prone to just crying whenever you listen to sappy music or watch a romantic movie. And there is also like the cortisol really regulates all the monoamines, which is dopamine, noradrenaline, and serotonin. And they have quite a lot to do with your emotionality at overall. And if these are low, you're going to suffer from anhedonia. For example, if you're very low in T3, in active thyroid hormone or cortisol, your baseline state of your monoamines will be very low as well. And the intensity for your emotions, of your emotions will be very low. And also the propensity for your brain to generate them in the first place. And for me, I was quite anhedonic, especially socially anhedonic, has multiple reasons, but cortisol elevated my emotionality like nothing else, even to the point when I first started out, probably my dopaminergic neurotransmission went into overdrive. I was super emotional. I mean, it can even bother other people if they're just not used to emotional you, and now you're this super intense emotional guy because you change neurobiochemical parameters. But for me, it just showed me that cortisol is necessary for adequate emotionality. And think about why do you think that people during puberty, they're just basically emotional roller coasters going up and going down? Well, it's the cortisol, and it's also the sex hormones that are just they're all over the place, and usually they're very high. And also, once people stabilize and once people become more rational and more stoic as they get older, well, I mean, of course, they're getting wiser, but it's also, and I would even say more, that your hormones drop, especially the cortisol, the thyroid hormone, the sex hormones. And now you're much less emotional. But in terms of emotionality, I would say cortisol is probably the most important of the hormones, even though it's one nobody ever looks at.
Unbelievable. Just crazy. So, geez. So how do you define, because I know the anhedonia, I want to explore more on that, because for me, I mean, I've definitely experienced more the, have you looked into PSSD at all, like post-SSRI sexual dysfunction?
I haven't looked into it much, but I'm aware of what it is and how it's mediated.
Yeah, because I'm still convinced that there's a cortisol aspect to that. Like, I think there's a, like, yeah, that emotional depth that completely dissipates in those going, because, like, have you looked into, like, how serotonin influences cortisol?
Yeah, I probably have to disagree with you. I would say it's the other way around. So the reason, in my opinion, why hormones influence emotionality is because they mainly because they regulate monoamines. They do act directly on certain brain centers, like your cingulate cortices, your amygdala, various parts in the brainstem, hypothalamus. But the main way they do is via monoamines. And if you use SSRIs, you basically bypass the hormones. You directly influence the monoamines. And let's say for erectile dysfunction or libido issues, it all depends on a very complex interplay between serotonin and dopamine. It doesn't matter how you change the two, whether you use drugs like amphetamines, lilaginine, or SSRIs to increase, or pramipexole, a direct dopamine agonist, or use the hormones. They all converge basically on the balance between these neurotransmitters. And with the SSRIs, the serotonergic tone is very important for libido. If it's too high, especially the amplitude, your libido is going to be very low. By amplitude, I mean, let's say you have something that increases serotonin, like your estradiol, which increases serotonin a lot. But now, the estradiol increases serotonin expression. And so if you look at the levels of serotonin in the synaptic cleft, there is going to be a lot of amplitude there. The release induced by estradiol is much higher compared to no estradiol. So we have a lot of amplitude. But if you use SSRIs, they keep the serotonin in the cleft, which means the amplitude with serotonin release is lower. So there is like a very little fluctuating level of serotonin there. And that has a lot to do with how libido is regulated. Mm. And this is the main reason why, because there's no amplitude anymore, why SSRIs decrease libido.
Fascinating. So
yeah, the exact same mechanism would be, let's say you use modafinil or something that blocks the reuptake of dopamine. So now if we block the reuptake, there is not much amplitude in the synaptic cleft. But if you use amphetamine or xylalagine, something that induces a release of dopamine or cortisol or testosterone, then we do have a lot of amplitude there. And this is going to elevate the libido, increase amplitude changes. Because if you, it's not directly elevating the libido, but if you have a lot of neurotransmitter floating around all the time, for example, SSRIs with serotonin and dopamine with reuptake inhibitors, then there is downregulation on the postsynaptic receptors because they are stimulated all the time. And this downregulation leads to reduced neurotransmission. Now it's getting very technical.
I want to hear about some of your, like, the most ideal stack to, like, supercharge libido. So, like, let's sort of explore that because I do a lot of work. Yeah.
All right. The most ideal stack. I mean, there are just so many different avenues how you can target that. I mean, you could increase dopamine amplitude by a drug, for example, xylalagine, which is a MAO B inhibitor, an enzyme that inhibits monoamine oxidase B, xylalagine, exactly. You could increase testosterone. You could make sure that your DHT is high. You could make sure for males that your estradiol is in range. I've written go to my blog. And go to, I added a section yesterday because I had a client, I do online consultations, and his main issue was libido issues. And so I thought, yeah, maybe there are many. Go to the how to replace male hormones. And I thought many people might have libido issues, and so I might as well check out, write a short section about libido. And I added it there. And you can basically, I made a list of what impacts libido, and you can screw around with any of these variables. It should be towards the bottom.
So, so true. I'm sure you've seen when guys crush their estradiol.
Yeah.
Zero libido, yeah?
Zero libido. Oh, estradiol is probably the sensitive most guys are most sensitive to. So if your estradiol is very high, zero libido. If it's very low, zero libido.
You know, there's one thing I've heard about is SARMs. Now, you know, RAD 140, it's quite a...
Yeah.
I've heard that that can crush SHBG. Now I'm thinking maybe in my situation, too risky.
I think actually I would stay the hell away from SARMs because you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if that if it's an anabolic steroid, just the anabol or something else, just disguised as a SARM. You have no way to check unless you have access to laboratory university equipment. But but everything that increases androgen signaling in the liver, that's going to crush your SHBG. And if you do oral SARMs, then yeah, of course, you're going to crush your SHBG.
Right.
There's libido. I mean, there's a list of things that increase it. And I said the two most important neurotransmitters are dopamine and serotonin signaling. And then there are multiple hormones that affect this neurotransmitter system. And as well, there is oxytocin and alpha MSH. Right. These two are very important for libido. They are like neurotransmitter peptides.
Increases fluids, estradiol.
So if your prostate gland fills, you're going to have higher libido. Because that's the reason why people that don't jerk off, their libido increases. It's not because their testosterone increases. No, it's the other way around. You don't jerk off, your prostate gland fills, there are afferent nerve signals going to your brain. Then libido is getting higher, and now GnRH secretion and downstream testosterone secretion is increased. So this tiny increase in testosterone is secondary to you not jerking off, but it's not the reason why your libido is higher.
Did you ever experiment with oxytocin at all?
I tried it a few times, yeah.
Did it have much of an effect, or you probably weren't deficient?
No, I certainly wasn't deficient because hormones regulate, especially estradiol regulates oxytocin. I mean, me and one of my best friends, I was in the hospital, I was working in gynecology, and I've seen some oxytocin in the fridge, and I've just taken it, and we just injected it intramuscularly to see whether it has an effect. I mean, it's very hard to tell because the effects are very subtle, but I did notice a significant boost in libido the next day. Usually my libido is quite low for some reason. I don't mind it because I think libido is quite distracting, especially if you want to be productive. But to me, I don't know whether it was placebo or not, or whether it was just coincidence. The next day, my libido was quite high.
Mm. Just jumping back to thyroid, in the scenario where somebody has too much T4 and insufficient T3, what may that present as? Like, what have you seen?
What the person looks like, or?
Well, maybe their general vigor, vitality, like do they, because they're not converting much. I know T4.
It's basically the phenotype of hypothyroidism. It's the exact same thing.
Right.
People call it thyroid sensitivity, but it's much more conversion issues in the peripheral tissues by the enzymes called deiodinases, which deiodinate T4 to T3 or reverse T3. And if that process is screwed up, then your tissue exposure to the active form of thyroid hormone is much lower, and which is the same as you are not getting enough thyroid hormone overall. Just because something is much higher in the blood, it doesn't really matter. We really need to look at cellular action, and there is just no way to determine cellular levels. And we don't really have biomarkers for hormones. We just have signs and symptoms, but no real clear-cut biomarkers we can measure, unfortunately. And that holds for all the hormones. So just looking at blood tests, that is probably the most common misconception people have when they check their hormones. It's not just about blood. It's not about what is wrong, folding around in your blood. It's about what is doing the thing in the cell. And we cannot measure that, unfortunately.
I experimented with pregnenolone, and I thought that was going to be a good strategy to help with my low cortisol, but that ended up making me like pissing and urinating like crazy, and I didn't respond well to it.
There are just so many pathways that can be impacted if you give more of a precursor steroid. I mean, it could mess up your aldosterone, it could mess up your cortisol. You don't really know what pathways the thing is shunted into. And I mean, what was your dosage like?
It was It was between 5 to 10 milligrams.
It's not right, so that's very low dosage.
It was low dose, yeah.
Yeah, weird. I can't comment on that. I mean, it could be due to multiple things.
Hmm.
Most likely reason is that it impacted aldosterone.
That's what I think. Way. Actually, what I want to talk about is cyproheptadine. Have you had much experience with cyproheptadine?
I just used it one time when I was doing MDMA with a very good friend, and it's basically an antidote to MDMA overdosage. So I had some on me. But other than that, I have literally no experience. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because I did make a whole thread on how cyproheptadine has an amazing rebound effect. And I'm thinking that maybe it's just a rise in cortisol once it leaves the system because it's used to treat Cushing's.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking maybe the reason why I'm feeling so...
Oh, is it? I don't even know that.
Yeah.
Is it used to treat Cushing's?
Okay. Yeah. Because it's first-generation antihistamine, but then it's also blocks ACTH, aldosterone, cortisol, adrenaline.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a...
Yeah, it blocks all the neurotransmitters. But the question is, yeah, you might have a rebound in cortisol. That is physiological. That's very possible. But it's not going to do much in the long term.
No. Because then because that rebound will last maybe like 3 to 5 days and then back to baseline. So it was not... Yeah. It wasn't
One thing I found funny you mentioned that. I hope you were not against me talking about my personal experiments with certain molecules. But one thing I found that does the opposite is a microdose of LSD. LSD at a 5-HT2A receptor stimulates cortisol secretion like crazy. Mm. This is why you feel very awake and alert and have no hunger in LSD. But because of this high cortisol, I mean, in the clinical setting, area under the curve cortisol is quadrupled to even 5 to 6 times higher. But this leads to negative feedback. And 1 or 2 days after, you feel like crap because your cortisol does not rise anymore. So it's basically the reverse. There's not going to be any long-term impact, but it's just the acute effect of increased or decreased negative feedback.
Interesting. What about psilocybin? Has that affected... Like, have you noticed any cortisol-like effects from that?
I just microdosed with psilocybin once or twice, so I can comment on that. But it's probably the exact same mechanism, but to much lower extent because its half-life is around like 6 hours.
Yes.
Whereas LSD binds very strongly to the receptor for like 15 to 16 hours.
Mm.
So I would just say it's much, much lesser in amplitude and effect size.
Now, I'm curious to know more about, I know I'm jumping around between topics, but I want to go back to prolactin. The general rule of thumb, and I've looked into it as well, high prolactin, not good for men. But I've also seen some research showing that very low prolactin can mimic the effects of like low DHT. Have you seen?
I'm sorry, I can't comment on that. I have literally no idea. I think prolactin could also be more like a secondary marker. Whether it directly does something or not, we would need clinical experiments what prolactin infusion or administration really does. Right. But unfortunately, in males, we don't have that.
Because, I'm wondering if the... I'm wondering if the relaxation and the calm down, but the feeling of, once a man orgasms, I'm wondering if that is the central mediator or is it just a dissipation of like oxytocin?
Nobody knows. Some people say it's oxytocin. Some say it's prolactin. Some say it's just because you were dopamine and or adrenaline decrease. Some say it's a rise in serotonin. It's probably a combination of all these things.
Yeah.
And it's usually never, this is the thing, because if we experimentally blocked one or the other, we would probably still find similar effects, but to a much lesser extent.
Mm.
It's usually really an interplay of multiple things. I mean, everything in our body, and especially in our brain, is highly redundant. There are some things that are essential, but other than that, there are usually multiple feedback loops that do, or multiple ways that do the exact same thing at the exact same time. It's very robust. If you take out one of these, the whole system is still going to work somewhat. The feedback gain is not 100%, but it's, I mean, robustness is one reason why we vertebrates, we complex multicellular animals are so hard to kill. Like an adult vertebrate, unless you take out a vital function, yeah, it's very hard to take down. I mean, pharmacologically, we can block so much. We can block the most important immune mediators, and your whole immune system is just, there's just a slight change in equilibria. The exact same is with hormones. You can live with 20 times the amount of testosterone in your body for years, or with no testosterone, your body is still going to function. And the same is with, like, what is the reason why you're tired after sex? I mean, or after orgasm? I think it might, or is probably due to a multitude of things.
Mm.
And whether prolactin has any effect, I don't know.
Mm.
I actually think no, because prolactin activates a state receptor. It's like a very complex, ancient type of receptor that changes gene expression. And for gene expression to occur, we need like half an hour-ish to a few hours. And the tiredness and fatigue is occurring right after we orgasm. It's probably related to the monoamine transmitters, like histamine, especially a drop in histamine, a drop in noradrenaline, a drop in dopamine, and rise in serotonin.
Fascinating.
I think. I mean, I'm just making an educated guess here.
Now I'm bridging all the knowledge that I have, and that's making the connections there. I want to discuss a little bit about diet. So I want to know more about, let's talk about some of the dietary interventions. What works well for you
in terms of libido or general health or
general energy? Let's talk about energy.
I'm a very bad example to talk about. I mean, I found what works for me, but as I keep all my hormones constant, it's very hard for me to say whether my diet would naturally, when my hormones would respond and fluctuate depending on what I eat and how I eat, whether that would make me feel better or worse. I don't know. So my diet is usually a paleo type of diet. I've written an article about it, a diet everyone does well on, it's called. And those are basically the things I adhere to. Yeah, it's the last article in that list.
Interesting. Let's talk about, I want to talk about what are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen guys make when it comes to hormone, like replacement therapy? What are some of the silly mistakes you've seen?
What are some of the dumbest things I've seen?
Like, do they think more is better or like?
Yeah, that's usually the case. Most people think more is better. Or one of the most common misconceptions, I wouldn't say it's a dumb thing to do because it's a very human thing to do. Most people, when they replace a hormone, let's say testosterone or thyroid or cortisol, and their symptoms do not fully improve, they increase the dosage of this hormone and they think, I'm feeling better now. Symptoms are going down. It must be this hormone that is causing my symptoms. And then they go up into these super physiological crazy doses. But that is the problem. And we need to have the hormones in balance. If one of our hormones is low, this is going to be a limiting factor. Of course, increasing testosterone, cortisol, thyroid, they're all stimulating. They can all be abused as stimulants. And many people abuse them as stimulants to reduce symptoms. But they think one is better than two. No, it's not. I mean, it's much healthier to use multiple hormones at small physiological doses in a way that our cells are evolved to respond to them compared to going very high in a single hormone. I have seen absurd dosages, not even just for bodybuilding purposes, but also for thyroid and cortisol, where people are just compensating for the other. I mean, they're low in thyroid and cortisol, and they just go either crazy high in thyroid or either crazy high in cortisol. And that's going to have very detrimental effects on you and downstream you.
Yeah.
So it's probably the most common misconception or the thing people do wrong. They do not add multiple hormones at very small dosages because they think one is better than two.
Yeah.
It's much healthier to do it the other way, to balance the hormones.
Makes complete sense. Makes sense. Yeah. All right. We'll go back to diet. Cause I remember when I read this, when I skimmed through this article, this is the most important point, that I think, yeah, this is a big point. You need to deserve your carbs. And this is something that I've been personally playing around with. I used to be very liberal. Like I used to not really care about it. I just, have a very, very high carb diet, like 600 grams a day. But now what I've noticed is I'm carb backloading and I'm pushing my carbs back later in the evening. And I'm wondering, maybe that's what's, helping with the cortisol. Because, is it true that on a keto diet, you're eliminating carbohydrates, going to increase cortisol, right?
I'm like, yeah. But that's also a problem. So let's say you start out a keto diet and your cells are not adapted yet on a genomic level to use fatty acids and ketone bodies efficiently. So they need the glucose and your brain is now sensing glucose deprivation. What does it do? What is the name glucocorticoid? It is actually a glucose-producing hormone. Cortisol's one of the many roles of cortisols are increasing gluconeogenesis in the liver and the kidneys to some extent, especially in the liver. And now you are deprived of glucose and the plasma nutrients, and cortisol increase is going to increase. And people feel energetic. They feel well. They feel great. They have a clear head. They have energy. Yeah, that's your cortisol through the roof. Same thing as occurs in this first state of passionate love. But the reason is some people, for some reason, they burn out. Their HPA crashes down the line. After 3 months, they just crash. Their cortisol does not rise in the morning anymore. They need to keep fasting, cold showering, all these cortisol-raising activities to basically just offset the very low baseline cortisol, but that's just adding fuel to the fire. And it happens so many times that people screw up their hormonal health, and sometimes even permanently, by doing these crazy dietary regimens that do work for some people. Some people do very well on a keto diet for years. There are certainly many factors that have an effect on that. For example, how much is T3 going to drop? Some people, they have single nucleotide polymorphisms, different enzymes that mediate this conversion. And if you're one of the lucky ones, for example, your T3 is not going to drop. You're still going to have the energy. But if you're unlucky, then yeah, you might, a keto diet might not be very good for you. And of course, it also depends on other hormones and your general state of health. But I would say, as a general recommendation, I would caution against being on a keto diet for extended periods of time, because for most people, it is very bad for hormonal balance. It's a great way to become healthy, to lose body fat, to reverse metabolic syndrome, to decrease insulin resistance. But once you're already lean, then you're just pushing down leptin and also the low area under the curve insulin. They are both very stimulating to all of your hormones. It's going to be very bad for your hormonal health. And then you have to compare what are the downsides of a high carbohydrate diet. And what are the downsides of a low-carbohydrate diet but crappy hormones? And I would actually say the crappy hormones are much worse than a high-carbohydrate diet, especially for how you feel on a daily basis and how you function. So I would, most people advise to like stay between 100 and 200 gram complex and slow-release carbs. That's where you can do much damage. And you can even do some physical activity. And of course, some people do better on a full-blown keto, and some people do better on the higher range of carbs. But as a general, generic prescription, I would say that it's like the best. Yeah.
One point I want to explore is, how does a low-carbohydrate diet influence the conversion of T4 to T3? Is it because the liver doesn't have enough glycogen? We need glycogen. Like, what
is
that?
It's the insulin.
It's the insulin.
Insulin is perhaps one of the main stimulators of T4 to T3 conversion.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. But you don't need to eat carbs to have insulin. I mean, lean meats does it as well. Yeah. Whether glycogen storage has an impact or influence, maybe. I don't know. But it's certainly the insulin that does a lot of the conversion, that initiates the conversion process. Yeah. I mean, T3 is a carbohydrate metabolizing hormone. So whenever your thyroid increases, you do metabolize more carbs. So there is a physiological, it does make evolutionary sense that if insulin, the storage hormone, the most anabolic hormone we have, rises, that, yeah, use this fast energy you now just got. It does stimulate also glycolysis at the same time. And T3 does so as well.
Fascinating. What about, I'm curious to know more about, like, how do you respond to dairy?
Dairy is one of my weak points. I think I do not very well on dairy, especially dairy protein. But I like it a lot. I do eat yogurt and I do eat like cream, like spray cream, which is like kind of Swedish, but it's certainly not optimal. But I know that many people do very badly on dairy, especially in terms of like the lipid profile and inflammatory markers. Once they drop dairy, their gut issues just go away. Their inflammatory markers drop. Their insulin resistance decreases because it's mostly due to the protein fraction of dairy. It's not because of the lactose, most people think, because the whey and the casein, they are both hormonally active. Mm. I mean, it does make sense that for mammals who basically depend solely on breast milk during their early life, that they do get hormonal stimulation from the food they eat. And actually there are hypotheses that the whey and casein protein, they are transcytosed, which means they are actually picked up from the intestines and shuttled directly into the bloodstream as whole proteins without being degraded to some extent. And they might act directly on the liver and the pancreas. So whey does, for some reason, and potently stimulate insulin secretion. It could also be mediated by the vagus nerve. We don't know. But for another reason, the casein, if you separate whey and casein, and you have two groups, and you give one group the whey and one group the casein, the whey group is going to have a much higher insulin release than what could be predicted from the protein and carbohydrate content. And the casein fraction does have no effect on insulin, but their IGF-1 is going to rise. We don't know why, but it has been tested many times.
Mm. Did you say you've also experimented with growth hormone as well? Like you,
I am on growth hormone.
Oh, really? Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I take one IU per day.
Like at night, or
no? Most people advise at night, but I find my sleep is much better, paradoxically, if I take it in the morning.
Crazy. It's the complete opposite of what you.
I know. I mean, many people actually.
How do you track your sleep though? Do you use Oura?
I use the Oura Ring, and I do wake up very early, and my sleep is much more restless if I use the growth hormone at night.
I'm sort of making links now because whenever I use the sauna, I've got an infrared sauna. Yeah. Whenever I use that at night, it spikes growth hormone. I'm wondering, and my sleep is shocking, like really shit.
Yeah. Crazy. It could also be related to body temperature, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be many things. But for me, I'm very empirical and quite scientific in my approaches. I'm very sure that, at least for me, growth hormone does reduce the quality of my sleep if I take it at night. It does increase overall quality of sleep if I take it in the morning. But then it's not the growth hormone anymore. Then it's the IGF-1 that rises. Mm. So higher IGF-1 leads to a better, more efficient sleep. But growth hormone per se seems to stimulate adrenaline to a certain extent. Funny anecdote, my dad is now 50. I wanted to put him on growth hormone. I gave him some and I said, yeah, just inject the tiniest dose at night. I did it for 2 days. He stopped because he could not sleep. He was fully awake for the first hours. Jeez. Probably he had palpitations. It was this tiny dose in growth hormone. It's probably induced very high state of sympathetic drive and adrenaline release. And it might be a genetic thing. It might hold for some people. And I seem to be one of these. And if your sympathetic tone is higher during the night, your sleep is much more fragmented, you have less slow wave sleep, perhaps a little more REM sleep. And for me, it seems to be the case.
So why growth hormone despite being so young? You know, like, is it, you still think it's going to, like, you still think it's necessary?
No. I mean, yes and no. I think it's best to keep IGF-1 between 2 and 300. And given I'm on a ketogenic-like diet, my IGF-1 was, without the growth hormone, well below 200. I just wanted to have it in the optimum range. I don't want to go above 300. Like, bodybuilders go up to like 700-800 nanogram per milliliters. I want to titrate my IGF-1 to be, it's actually on the lower end of 200 right now. So I could be well within the normal variation existing in the population. So I'm actually at the 70th or 60th percentile. And I think the risk of doing this is lower than the risk of not doing it. But I do 4 times a year. I do like a fasting mimicking diet for 5 days, and I get my IGF-1 to really the 1 or 2nd percentile, so to very low levels, like 100. But I think it's very great for general rejuvenation, especially if I after spike the IGF-1 again. Again, all many senescent cells are going to be eliminated while new stem cells proliferate.
Interesting. How common is IGF-1 deficiency?
Very hard to say, but IGF-1 does drop with age. And IGF-1 is very important for vigor. I mean, it's one of these hormones that most people are scared of. IGF-1 in cancer, IGF-1 in longevity, Laron syndrome, we have no growth hormone receptor. Yeah, but of course, in lower lift, shorter lift mammals, it's going to have a very potent effect. But in mammals like us, and we already have many genetic adaptations that favor a long lifespan, and some of them are mediated by the IGF-1 pathway. Mm. And if we have very high IGF-1, we might reach the hay flick limit faster, which is the telomere erosion, which means our cells can't divide anymore. And we also might drive cancers, but it's very well a U-shaped curve there. If we have very low IGF-1, we also have an increase in cancers because it's very important for the immune system. And immune system is our main weapon to fight incipient cancers. And also, one thing that is most neglected with hormones is we just look what does the hormone directly to our body. But we also need to look how does the hormone influence our lifestyle. So if we have high IGF-1 or normal IGF-1, we have more vigor, we have more energy, we feel more vital, which means we have the energy and motivation required to sleep well, to eat well, to exercise. And most of the diseases we have, they're lifestyle diseases. So cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative, Alzheimer's, they are tightly linked to lifestyle choices we make. And if a hormone gives us energy and motivation, I mean, then our lifestyle is going to be better. And that has a very potent effect. Usually, in my opinion, this especially holds for T3 and IGF-1, two hormones that, if given high enough dosage, shorten lifespan. But let's say you get them to the 60th percentile. I think the effect they have, first, direct effect on tissues, but also the direct effect on your well-being and energy and mood, leading you to making smarter lifestyle choices, regardless of that you feel much better from moment to moment. And life is just a string of individual moments right next to each other. But it's all going to be like beneficial for your lifespan, I think. And also life is about like living, about feeling time, and not just passing it. I mean, I want to live to 100 and kick ass. I don't want to just vegetate like a vegetable, being cold and feeling crappy all the time.
Oh, 100%, man. 100%. You know, as I was going through these articles, I was thinking, you know, it'd be so useful if you probably thought of this, but to maybe like present this in a mind map or some sort of visual that shows people, like, you know, you've seen the very technical hormone maps, but maybe like, you know, testosterone, thyroid, and then just explaining like this influences this, you know, maybe.
It's just so hard. There's so many factors, and you really need to do a lot of studying to even grasp the principles.
Yeah.
And I think it's a topic that is just so complex. There are certainly ways how you can simplify things, but you really need to have a very good understanding of physiology, biochemistry, some genetics, pathology, to even begin. To grasp the effects these hormones have and what is influencing what and why. And I don't know whether it's feasible, but also I'm not very creative in that kind of sense. So it's not, I would not be the right person to do that.
Yeah.
My time would be better spent writing articles, I guess.
Well, I mean,
thanks for the suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that maybe we can do a collaboration on, perhaps maybe down the track. I don't know. I've got a good, I've got a good team behind me that can help with, you know, orchestrating. Doesn't have to be nowhere near as technical as what you're explaining now, but just a very brief overview. I know because I'm the same as you, don't like to just skim the surface, but it would be useful because people...
It would be so useful, I mean, if you have any ideas how that can be approached in real life, hit me up. I'm very open to that.
Yeah. It'd be a good way to... Well, I don't know if you have plans on, expanding upon this. Like, what are your future endeavors? Like, what does that look like?
So at first, I just wanted to actually share my story. It's called How Hormones Destroyed and Saved My Life. I published it on Medium. And some people actually hit me up and they asked, like, what do I take and how do I take it? And then I started to lay out my protocol, actually on a Reddit post. It was just a Reddit post. And the response was super great and super interesting. And I thought, like, yeah, maybe I can do a follow-up article, how I replace my hormones. And it was like a 2-minute read or a 3-minute read here on Medium. And then I started to add more stuff. And then it got to like a 20-minute read. And then one day people were hitting me up on they were just contacting me how to replace the individual hormones and common pitfalls they have and stuff like that. And then I started, on a single day, I wrote like very short guides how to replace the hormones. So for all the 5 hormones, I wrote like a 5-minute read thing. And then it started to expand, and it has been this project now for like the last month. And as I've been reviewing my old notes, which I've taken my notebook, I found like many interesting nuggets. I thought they cannot be found in a very comprehensive and non-technical way somewhere on the internet. And so I started to write like ultimate guides on how to replace these hormones. For the only guide I don't go in depth in the practical part is cortisol, because I think I don't want to be the guy that tells people how they should do it, because it can be dangerous. And before anyone does that, I would rather have a short conversation with them via Skype or email to really get to know the person, because I don't want to be responsible neither legally nor personally for any damage done.
Of course. Well, look, man, I'm very grateful you came on the show. And is this your first... Like, is this your first podcast or?
That's my third podcast. But the other was just a super random podcast from a guy from Germany. Has like, I don't know how big your podcast is. I'm honest, I've not checked it out. But the other was like quite small, like 500 to 1,000 views.
Yeah. No, this will get a lot more publicity. And I think you 100% deserve it. And that's why I brought you on the show, because like, the stuff you're doing, man, it's gonna change people's lives. You've seen it change your own life. You know, it's really impactful stuff, and it's again stuff that no one's talking about. So,
thanks
for coming on the show, man. I'm gonna hit the.
Thanks for having me.
I'm gonna stop recording now.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.